You can't expect me to know things about the world. I'm from America.
The New Show One. I'm Joe.
I'm Alan.
And I'm Dan.
And we're back. And we've got a bunch of questions for you. You can submit those questions either emailing us, show@thenew.show, or on Twitter, just tweet at us, @AskNewShow. And if you want to support the creation of these episodes, you can go to patreon.com/AskNewShow. And for $5 or more, you can get an advert-free RSS feed. So the first one then, what's your favorite thing?
This is a really tough one because I want to say pizza because I can't really think of much else. It's got to be like booze or pizza. It's got to be one of those two, eating real bad or getting real drunk.
I really expected you to go for the cat or, you know, some thing that you really value, like a challenge coin given to you by someone in the military or, you know, something really memorable, something really adorable, but you actually just went for pizza.
Well, you know, it's not a thing. He's a cat.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I would say my favorite person is probably my wife, but she's not a thing, so I wouldn't say her. And I could maybe say that my favorite guitar is my Flying V, but that is not a thing. That's my beloved guitar.
That's a thing.
Okay, that is a thing. But
I disagree. All of these things you've listed are things. Like, people are things.
But are you like person, place, or thing? Like, is separate? Is it different? Like, a place isn't a thing either.
It's a thing on a map. It's a thing in a city record somewhere. It's a thing. All these things are things. What's that thing on the floor that's licking its bum right now? It's your cat.
That's not a thing. He's insulted.
I never thought there was a distinction between animate things and inanimate things. I think they're all just things. It's like, you know, in an object-oriented programming language, everything is an object. And so everything in the world is an object. They're just different classifications of objects.
Everything's a file.
Yeah, totally. So my favorite thing is my memory, because I thought about whether it would be a person or an animal, and I thought it doesn't matter which person I pick, I'm going to offend someone, and it doesn't matter which animal I pick, one of the others would be annoyed if they listened to this episode. So I think my memory, because it's something nobody can take away from you, and it has in it so many things that I can never share with anyone that I enjoyed throughout my life, and so my memory is my favorite thing because it's got stuff in there that I like.
I think of all the things in the world, my favorite is a nice warm bed, because you can enjoy almost all of the nice things in life in bed, whether that's a pizza or a TV show or a movie or just a nice sleep. And I like nothing better than a nice long sleep or to hang out in a nice warm, comfortable bed.
You can enjoy many of those things in a swimming pool.
Yeah.
Or lying on the grass. I guess a bed, yeah. I mean, given that you spend, I don't know, a significant percentage of your life, probably at least a third of your life in bed, I can see why it's a good thing.
If your favorite thing is a warm bed, now I don't understand why you were like, wow, I can't believe you'd spend that much on a mattress. You should have the most expensive mattress out of anybody.
You'd think that, wouldn't you? But what you can do is get a relatively affordable mattress and then put a foam topper on the top of it. And that makes it into an amazing mattress.
No, foam toppers are awful. I'm against this completely.
Well, you're wrong. There's no need to spend loads on a mattress, I don't think. I think you can buy a relatively cheap IKEA mattress, stick a topper on top. It's a bit inconvenient changing the sheets and everything, but comfort-wise, it's perfect.
I do quite enjoy if the wife gets out of bed early and I roll over and her side of the bed is cold because she's got out of the bed recently. I do quite enjoy that feeling of a new pillow and a new section of bed that I haven't been laying on. I think I prefer her side of the bed to my side of the bed simply because I have lots of good memories of rolling over and going, oh, that's nice, on her side of the bed when she's not in it.
Yeah, well, I sleep at very different times from my wife. And so there's that little crossover early in the morning. And then she gets out of bed and I stretch out over the whole bed. And it's like, ah, sweet.
Mm.
So I sympathize. What do you see as the typical desktop Linux user? This is from Peter.
Oh, this is hard.
Because
ask the same question of what do you see as the typical Windows user or what do you see as the typical Android user? It's lots and lots of diverse meat bags all around the planet doing different things. I think the Linux desktop is a little bit different in that it wasn't for most people, they didn't go into a big box store and pick whichever was the prettiest, cheapest, most performant laptop, take it home, and it had Linux on it. They probably made an active decision to install Linux. And so that changes the demographic a bit. I would say it's a niche. It's certainly a niche of not everyone. I know it's difficult because people seem to think as someone who works on Ubuntu, I should want Ubuntu to be installed everywhere for everyone. And I think I'm painfully aware that it doesn't work for everyone. There are some things that it's not good for and some things it's not ideal for. And that's the same for the Linux desktop in general.
This question could be answered two ways, right? It could be like, what do we think that the average Linux user is actually like, which there's probably a lot of people that are using Linux that don't even know they are, because I know that we get a lot of people that are like, yeah, I stuck it on my kid's computer or my mom's computer or whatever. And we know that there are deployments in companies and in governments and things like that. And you wonder, like, how many of these people just use it because that's what's there and they have no idea what it is. And if you ask them if they run Linux, that they would say that they don't know. Like, that's probably a pretty significant amount of people. And then there's like the perception of, well, what do you think the average Linux user is like? And then you imagine in your head, like this neckbeard guy with like 50 terminals up and, you know, recompiling the Linux kernel, eating a Hot Pocket.
I would argue that the kind of people you're talking about there, like people's mothers and kids or whatever, I think they're in the minority. I think the typical Linux desktop user is someone who's technical, not necessarily a developer, but someone who knows how a computer works, knows a bit about partitions and stuff, and maybe has built a desktop in their day at some point. So they, I think, outnumber vastly the people who don't know they're on it. But I may well be wrong. And Alan, you are probably going to prove me wrong with data or something.
No, I don't have a tremendous amount of data. But I would say if you look at the most popular applications, that gives you some kind of idea of the kind of people. I would certainly say, yes, there are computer enthusiasts, technical enthusiasts, which is the kind of person you describe. I don't know what proportion they are, but there's certainly a significant number of those because they're the kind of people who do technical support in their free time for Linux distributions. They're the kind of people who reply to people's questions on Reddit or sit in an IRC channel and answer questions. So those people are computer enthusiasts, almost certainly. They're getting involved, you know, even on the periphery, just answering the odd support question here and there. So there's definitely some of that. But if you look at the software that is most popular on Linux, a lot of it is developer-oriented stuff. So I would say if I'm picturing the archetypal Linux user, I would say a significant chunk are software developers because a lot of them install code editors and IDEs. I would say a chunk of them are embedded software developers working on things like IoT devices where the software stack on Linux is easier to talk to these IoT devices and they can build the software more easily on their Linux computer. DevOps engineers, the kind of people that Dell are trying to attract away from the Mac with the Sputnik, Dell XPS 13, that kind of thing. So they are all kind of a developer-y, technical enthusiast kind of person. I don't doubt there are plenty of mums, dads, children, grandparents who run Linux. But I think the vast majority fit into those technical segments of the market.
I would say, too, that we know that there are some very successful companies selling licenses or support contracts or physical devices to people that are in the sciences or in manufacturing or things of that nature to military.
I think probably the minority part, which might surprise some people. I think the minority is free software advocates. I think actually the people who are installing Linux because they are a Stallmanite who is fully paid up member of the FSF and is very much an FSF believer, I think they're a small minority of people who run Linux. I think the vast majority are quite happy to have a little bit of proprietary software, whether that's Spotify or Slack, or maybe they have Visual Studio Code, or they use the NVIDIA binary driver because they want to play some games and they install Steam and install some proprietary games. So I think some people think, as Dan said, the neckbeards who are free software advocates, people think that's the archetypal Linux user. I don't think that's the case anymore. I think that's a small subset of the audience.
Well, I think you find there are no free software advocates running Linux. They're all running GNU/Linux.
I do agree with Dan, though, that there are large deployments in companies and in governmental organizations where there's thousands and thousands of machines out there that just used for as an appliance, and the user will open a web browser or open some bespoke application and close it at the end of the day and walk away, and it won't even factor into anything, any conversation they have that they use Linux. They might have a conversation with someone at some point where the subject comes up, but I think that's pretty rare. I think more likely it's, hey guys, we've got this new computer system, here's how you use it. Okay. And they use it, and then they stop using it and they go home. I think that is a significantly sized chunk of Linux users that your average neckbeard doesn't appreciate.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of people working in Toolstation, which is kind of like a DIY type shop here in the UK. And all of their point of sale terminals are running Linux of some description. I never got to the bottom of what it was. It was like a GNOME 2 type desktop. So it was definitely, well, it could have been BSD, but it's very unlikely. And there must be at least 100 of those shops in the UK, and however many staff they have, like, I don't know, 10 people working in each one. So that's a fairly sizable chunk. And you would imagine there's probably similar deployments as well.
Well, I've seen that. I think I've seen that EPOS system in Maplin when Maplin still existed. And yeah, it looks like a GTK2 style. You can spot those icons a mile away.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't count those in this conversation because they're not desktop Linux users. They're using an appliance. You, if you're going to say them, you might as well say Android users or TiVo users or smart TVs that have Linux on them. You might as well say everyone is a Linux user then, and the demographic is as broad as it is for every other OS. I don't think you can include those.
Well, except that it does have a web browser that they can look stuff up in.
And it's still an appliance.
True.
I think it's like a Linux, a TV that's running Linux, whatever version of, whether it's some embedded Linux or whether it's running Android, it's not desktop Linux, even if it's got a browser on there that you need in order to authenticate to Netflix or whatever. It's still not desktop Linux, even if it's got a graphical user interface. I think I wouldn't include Chrome OS in there either, although, you know, that you could argue that one.
Well, yeah, actually, if you do count Chrome OS as desktop Linux, which arguably it is, then there's probably more Chrome OS users than any other Linux desktop. I don't know. How many Chrome devices are there out there? There's got to be millions, surely.
Who knows? I think the sales figures are made public in, you know, PR announcements for all of the different vendors, but I don't know if there's an aggregate number for how many Chrome OS devices, but that would certainly skew the demographic, because Chrome OS devices are commonly used in educational establishments because they're easier to lock down and there's no data locally and you can throw them away and pick up another one when they break. And so they're popular in that environment. So that would certainly change from everyone is a software developer using Linux to students, you know, anyone. My mum uses Chrome OS. So, yeah, she's a Linux user as well then.
Yeah, but I think that's going to trigger a lot of people. In fact, I know it will. I've said it before on shows and had people argue strongly that Chrome OS is not the Linux desktop, but it is a desktop computer, well, laptop, whatever, running a Linux kernel and essentially a shell on top of that. I mean, it's not really any different. It might be more proprietary than your typical Linux desktop, but I think it is. So yeah, I think we've got to the bottom of this. I think it's, yeah, someone with a Chromebook is a typical desktop Linux user.
Send your feedback to show at thenew.show.
Or tweet at us at AskNewShow.
Tell us why Joe's wrong.
If you ended up in a situation where you had to prove that you're not the clone or evil twin, how would you do it?
I've got a problem with this, because if I tell you, then when the clone comes along, then they're going to know how I'm going to reveal that I'm not the clone.
I mean, usually the way to prove that you're not a clone is with like some kind of scar or something, right? Because the new body shouldn't have the same scars that you had.
Well, this is the problem. And another question is, how was the clone made? You know, if it's some kind of bit for bit copy of me as I'm sat here right now, then with all my memories, then that's very difficult for me to say I'm not the evil twin, unless there was a malfunction in the copy and it had a goatee beard and I don't, then it would be really obvious. But if it's a clone from stem cells and it's grown in a lab to be 48 years old, who would do that? Then okay, then it does, and it doesn't have my memories, or have they done some kind of mind injection thing of all of my social media posts so it can infer from that via AI and machine learning stuff about me, and it's listened to every podcast I've been on and all these stupid facts that I talk about and anecdotes, and so it knows a lot about me because I'm stupid enough to put all this out there in the public. Is it that or what? I think we need to know what kind of clone this is before I'm going to reveal how I would get myself out of that situation.
That's a good question. That's a good question. Let's go with the clone that it has your memories. Either the teleporter has malfunctioned and didn't destroy the original and or copy, or there's some kind of cloning process where it copies your current memory too. It's like a bit for bit copy. Like, how do you prove that you're the original and not the copy?
I think the big question is, what's the outcome? Because if there's two of me that are identical bit for bit and the wrong one gets chosen, what happens? Does the other one go, oh, all right, and leave? Or do they get smooshed into a bunch of mess and flushed down the toilet? What happens?
I suppose if you killed yourself and someone found the body, like, I don't know what would happen about that.
Well, if one of me killed the other me, why would I do that? I wouldn't kill anyone ever.
Presumably, one of you is going to be like, no, this is my house. This is my wife. These are my children.
Well, maybe, or maybe one of me will be like, freedom. Yay. I can piss off around the world. I can do whatever I want. I can live the dream and go and get some 19-year-old Dolly Bird. It'd be awesome. I mean, I am stretching it a bit here, obviously. And it wouldn't be me that wanted that. It would obviously be the other one that had flaws in the cloning process that would be thinking that. It wouldn't be me thinking that, of course.
Which one of you would come and do this show, though?
Not the world traveler, obviously. It'd be too inconvenient.
Yeah, why would I want to do a podcast? I'm going to be out there and living it up.
Yeah, but that one would have more life experience, and so I would have more to bring to the show.
Wow. So you'd pit Popey versus Popey, and you'd leave centrist dad at home, who, you know, he's no longer interesting, and you'd pick world traveler who dials it in from the Caribbean or wherever, or the moon, or wherever he gets to.
Or you could just both be on the show and argue with each other.
So then I think we've answered it. How we'd know who's the clone is that real Alan would still be Sandra's dad and he'd do the show, and clone Alan would be like, no, I don't need you guys. I'm traveling the world. I got bigger aspirations.
Well, what I would do is I'd get you both there and I'd say, right, define doing a Popey. And the clone would know about the ThinkPads thing, obviously, from public knowledge. And so he'd say, I collect ThinkPads. That's what doing a Popey is. And then the real you would say, ha-ha, no, shitting yourself at a cash machine.
No, that would not be the thing. Doing a Popey among some of my friends is me saying good night on some internet chat system and then not going to bed. And then a couple of hours later saying good night and everyone going, oh, we thought you went to bed 2 hours ago. That's doing a Popey.
What is your ideal phone display size? This is from Cassidy.
I have strong opinions on this.
I have very weak opinions. My current phone, I think, is 5.5, and that's fine. So 5.5 inches.
So the pinnacle of phone design was the iPhone 4S, don't at me. And it all went downhill from there. And while you're Googling, Joe, I can tell you it was a 3.5-inch screen. The iPhone 4S had a 3.5-inch screen, and that was perfect. I could stretch my hand to the top. I didn't have to hold it with one hand and touch the screen with the other. It was perfection. And also the glass front and glass back and the metal surround the outside. It was just gorgeous. Now, the iPhone SE is a near perfect facsimile of that phone. It doesn't have the glass back. It has a metal back. That is also excellent. And that's only a 4-inch screen. That's a good size. And then we get into the 5-inch territory. The OnePlus X has the design traits of the 4S. So it has the glass front and back and the metal around the sides, but we're now up to 5 inches. And that I think is pushing it. So somewhere around 4 or 5 inches. And yeah, I'm the same as you. My current phone is 5.5. It's a OnePlus 5 and I'm not happy about it. I stretch to get to the top and I don't like that, but those two iPhones and the OnePlus X are probably the pinnacle of phone and nobody should make phones any bigger than that.
I think that a year ago or so, I would have absolutely agreed. I love the iPhone SE design. I think that's a great design. And it, there's a lot of rumors that they're coming back around to that general design language for the next iPhone. So that's pretty hype because that's a damn good phone design. But I've had a XS for a little while now, which is a 5.8-inch screen, and it is too big, but I feel like now when I hold an SE, it feels a little on the small side. I think I live somewhere in between. I think maybe like 5 inches, I would be pretty happy. It doesn't need to be this big, but maybe a little bit bigger than the SE. Or, you know, if the screen fills the bezels of the SE, like that would be pretty dope.
Okay, so there's two problems here. There's one is the physical size of the device, and the SE is a great size device. It's really small, fits perfectly in any hand. The OnePlus X, which is like 5-inch, is not much bigger, but I can certainly see the benefit, as you said, if you had the SE but stretched the screen towards the edges. Yeah, I would go with that. I would go with that. A full screen across the front, that would be nice. So that would probably be what, 4.5, getting towards 5 inches once you get that big. I would allow that.
But what about aspect ratio? That's something that throws off these numbers, because a 5.5-inch old-school aspect ratio that's like a traditional laptop screen or whatever is different, feels very different from a long, tall screen.
I'm not going to allow square BlackBerry phones and stupid shit like that. That's not happening. No. Like weird aspect ratios. I think some phones are a bit taller than others. Some phones are a bit wider than others. All of them are okay. So long as they fit in your hand, I don't really care about the aspect ratio. It doesn't bother me at all.
It does feel like 16:9 feels really natural when you start doing things like watching videos, or when you realize like how many interfaces are just a list. It does seem to feel like that's better than having something more square.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, but modern phones aren't 16:9. They're, what is it, like 21:9 or whatever. If they're really tall, they're a little bit stretched out almost.
They should not exist, Joe.
I agree. And it annoys me that there are now quite a lot of YouTube creators who have that aspect ratio for the videos. And so when I'm watching them on my glorious 27-inch monitor, they've got black bars on them.
I don't really care about black bars. That's never bothered me. I'm more annoyed about the ability for me to be able to use the user interface. If there's black bars surrounding media, that this doesn't really matter.
So I just looked up, and it looks like the phone I'm currently using is 19.5:9.
Yeah, which is very tall.
It is very tall. And you're right, they do get around it by pillar boxing, which, you know, in a world with notches, I guess, like, makes sense that you do want to have some kind of pillar boxing because you don't want the notch, like, going over your video content.
Well, notches are stupid, though, aren't they?
If we could have no notches somehow, and a 16:9 screen that's between 4.5 and 5 inches, sounds pretty sweet.
I'd buy that. Make it so, Dan. Do a crowdfunder. Make it run elementary OS as well.
How many millions of dollars do we need? Was it 2 million?
We need 30 million, but if you raise about 12 million, that would probably be all right, yeah.
Yeah, and another couple of million for a slide-out QWERTY keyboard, please.
No slide-out keyboard and no fucking removable battery either.
What?
Yeah. What, do you want your phone to be 30 feet thick?
I would rather it be a tiny bit thicker and be able to remove my battery and replace it.
I put it to you, Dan, that a phone does not need to be 30 feet thick in order to have just the extra couple of millimeters necessary in order to be able to remove the plastic back cover and get the battery out.
No. Seal it up. Waterproof that bad boy. I want it tight.
No, this is where I'm going to nope out of this crowdfunder, I'm afraid, Dan. You don't have me on board.
I think it was in one of the Johnny Ive videos where it was like, the new iPhone doesn't feel created. It feels like it just is.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Good job he left, eh? Do you believe in karma?
Yes, but maybe not in necessarily like a supernatural way, but in more of a like, the world is only so big and you get back what you put out. And if you're not a very good person, then chances are people around you will not treat you very well. And if you are generally shaping your environment in a positive way, that you'll get that positive feedback. I guess that's not true for all people, right? But like all things being equal, I would say that you kind of get back what you put in.
I like to think that's the case. I strive to be a positive influence on the world. And in small ways, I think karma does work. Like at the, shall we say, the local level, when you go to a retailer and, you know, you're friendly and courteous and not stroppy with them. They're just other human beings. They just have a different job. They just see life in a different way than you do because they're on the other side of, you know, the transaction, and they will be nice to you in return. I think karma works at that level, low level. I think scaling up, it doesn't work. So someone who has made billions and has got to a position of power, I don't believe for a second that they're a 100% wholesome good person. But I can't necessarily hold myself to that standard either. I can't necessarily say I am 100% wholesome good person. I try, and I think most people try, but I think some people do not try, and those people might not get the retribution they deserve, and there's nothing you can do about that.
Well, clearly it doesn't always work, karma, because you have a lot of bastards making a lot of money and having a lot of power in the world, and a lot of world leaders are psychopaths who just don't give a shit about anything other than themselves. But what about this idea that if you are not a psychopath and you do have empathy and everything, then just by doing bad things, then you feel bad about it. And then if you are in a kind of negative mental place, then things go wrong for you and you kind of have this compounding effect. And it's not necessarily just as straightforward as I am nice to this, server in a restaurant and therefore they don't spit in my food. It's, I think, more complex than that. I think that if you genuinely feel good about how you go on and the vibes you put out into the world, for want of a better word, you feel more positive generally and good things happen to you because you're in that good place.
I don't know. It's really tricky because, you know, God told me to do this thing. Therefore, I'm on the side of like righteous justice, whereas the person on the other side thinks their God told them to do this thing. And you're both opposing sides and you're fighting, yet you both honestly believe you're fighting for the right thing.
Mm.
And, you know, there are people on a smaller scale. There are people who are what I would class as awful people who are con men and clearly are trying to con people out of, I don't know, kindness, money, whatever it might be. But some people can't see that. And I feel like there's nothing you can do about that. Well, there's not a lot you can do about that because you just look churlish and you should just move on and get on with your life and stop worrying about the people who are not positively contributing to the world.
I guess maybe there is also kind of a perception effect too, where if you are focused more on being positive and more receptive to positive things, that you will feel like your life is very positive and not dwell on the negative parts.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I hope so.
But if you're in a negative mindset, that you'll notice the negative things more. It's very easy to not notice the positives, right? Like it's really easy to go through a day and only think about all the bad things that happened. And it can be a lot harder sometimes to appreciate everything that went right.
Yeah. And if you have people around you that negatively influence you, it can drag you down. And I vividly remember being told by a boss many years ago that the entire office happiness pivots on whether I come in with a smile on my face first thing in the morning. And if I'm like down and grumpy, everyone is down and grumpy because they all feed off each other. It's a small office with like 5 people in it. But if you come in and you're super happy, people feed off that. And I think that's natural. If you try hard to be a positive influence on the people around you, it has a network effect to those people and then beyond those people to their network who you will have no visibility of.
And the supernatural belief of karma must have come from somewhere. Like most superstitions and supernatural beliefs or whatever, they come from some sort of reasonable-ish sounding cause. It's easy to think that there's a God when there's this blindingly bright thing in the sky that you can't even look at, and you know somehow you kind of intuit that that brings life, which it turns out that it actually does through photosynthesis and stuff. It's kind of logical to think that the sun is God, and that's probably, I think, where the myth came from. And similarly with karma, it is based somewhat in reality that if you go around being nice to people, well, reciprocal altruism, they call it, right? On a small scale, and maybe some of these deeper things that we've been talking about, by just being in a positive mood keeps everyone positive, and therefore it's just your perception that things are more positive.
It does seem like there's got to be like some kind of privilege associated with a belief in cosmic justice, though, right? Like if you're in an environment that doesn't seem to ever reward you, then I can see how it could be very hard to believe that you being a good person really matters. You know, like if you're just entrenched in poverty or some kind of other massive disadvantage, then I think in those situations, then karma probably doesn't really apply.
Well, that's where heaven and hell and stuff comes from. The idea that you'll be judged in the next life.
Yeah, I suppose that would get you to continue to believe in this system, right? It's kind of interesting that there's these systems that exist to kind of make us behave nicely, believing that, you know, we have to believe in justice. Otherwise, there's not much incentive for you to not just be completely selfish.
I partly got my current job through karma because the points system in Launchpad is called karma. And I clocked up a ton of karma through answering support questions. I was giving my time to support other people. I was doing something positive for the project. I wasn't being financially rewarded. There was no reward for me at all for doing it. And yet now I work for the company that set that up and I enjoy that job. So you could argue at a real basic level, yeah, totally it works.
What a coincidence. I got my current job through karma probably as well.